Welcome to episode 4 of the Haman Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast. My name is Debbie Simons, and this week we are going to be looking at Don Kleindienst's ever-evolving stories after the killing of Haman Lee, and we're going to finally put to rest the questions about those pesky timesheets. Were they faked or were they not? Hint, yes, they were. And we know that they were. End of discussion as far as things should stand, but we'll examine it just so everyone is happy. Before we get to all of this, though, I want to answer a question that I at least had in my own mind. It had occurred to me earlier and really came to mind even more as I was recording last week. And I want to make it clear to you, my audience, that while I have spent an enormous amount of time examining evidence, writing and rewriting and rereading all sorts of information, I am still evolving my own stories, still coming up with new ideas, even as I work on these podcast episodes. So the question that had occurred to me earlier was, well, now wait a minute here. If the idea is that Don Kleindienst and his mother want to get another man to help them move this body, another able-bodied man, why on earth go through all of this complicated rigmarole with Alonzo Sellers, when there's another able-bodied man living right up the road who's very closely related to Don, and that, of course, is Don's father, Don Kleindienst Jr. So you will remember, if you've listened to episode 1, that Don's father lives just about a third of a mile from the house where Catherine Michelle and Anita Baird live. So why on earth didn't Don and his mother just call Don Jr.? Well, the question probably answers itself if you've listened to that first episode. Don Kleindienst Jr. was a violent domestic abuser. We know that from police reports that are recorded on a paid PeopleSearch website that I consulted. We also know from public records that he was an abuser of alcohol and that he very much had a record of driving while impaired and general reckless behavior when he was under the influence of alcohol. If you haven't read or listened to that first episode, go back and do so. The police report that I quote is pretty harrowing. So if indeed the discussion even took place between Anita and her son, I can just imagine Anita Baird saying, "For heaven's sake, whatever you do, don't say a word about this to your father. The minute he gets drunk, he'll spill the beans." Plus, I am sure, just from the history of this whole thing, that the relationship between Anita Baird and her ex-husband was pretty toxic. It's kind of surprising that it seems to be the case that Don divided his time between the two households. There seems to be a distinction made in the police reports between Don's home address, which is abbreviated as HA, and his residence. I have speculated earlier that Don probably slept over at his dad's, but spent a great deal of time at his mom's. And I think that kind of explains the whole situation. The fact that Hay was going over to spend time with Don after work has to indicate that she was going over to that townhouse where he and his father lived. Hay would not have been going to a household with two other women living there, one of whom was her boyfriend's mother. She'd had enough of motherly oversight at this point in her life. Back to our story. As I say, in this episode, I want to look at the way Don developed the stories that he told. So let's backtrack just a bit here and look at January 13th and 14th. So the day that Hay disappears and we believe was killed sometime that afternoon before 3:15, the pickup time at the daycare center, which she never missed, and February 4th. Let's go back and look at the 13th and the 14th. So last time I mentioned that there was a phone call made by Officer Scott Adcock, who was on patrol at the time that the Lees called in the missing persons report on Hay, and he was sent over. He was given Hay's diary and her address book, and he made a number of calls, one of which was to Adnan, but Adnan was just part of the mix, and one was to Don Kleindienst, whom he had been told by Young Lee, Hay's brother, was his sister's new boyfriend. He did not get a hold of Don until 1:30 the next morning. And at that point, he said, Don just simply said, I don't know where she is. I have not seen her since the night of the 12th. I have not heard from her since then. All right, so I mentioned last time that Adcock has come in for some criticism, Adcock and indeed the Baltimore County Police as a whole, because he did not press Don to say where he had been and why it had taken him so long to return this call. But again, I continued thinking about it. So I said last time, hey, you have to understand Adcock is not a detective. He's a patrol officer. He is doing basic questioning to find out what's going on with a certain situation, but he's not trained in interrogation. Actually, though, I think we need to realize that at this point, there is no crime. We know, of course, with our perspective, that murder has been committed, but as far as the police are concerned, nothing has happened except this 18-year-old girl who is a legal adult has disappeared with her car. That's a very important point. It's not that her car has been found abandoned somewhere with evidence of a struggle and she is missing, nothing like that. She's just vanished. So the clear implication is that she's just gone off somewhere. They have no legal right to go around pressing people with intrusive questions. So I think we can let Adcock off the hook here. He asks what he is supposed to ask, and that's it. So then, later on, during the day of the 14th, there is not an actual time given here, a second police officer calls Don. We think his last name may be Waters. The signature is very hard to read. Now, this is an interesting call. I don't think it's been given its full weight. So this is the police report that seems to make a distinction between where he resides and what his home address is. But what I want to point out here is that the report goes on to say Harford's County Sheriff was requested to check the area surrounding, and then the address is blacked out, but it's clearly one of Don's addresses. And remember, they're very close together, so it would be all the same area, for the victim and or her vehicle at that time with negative results. Isn't that interesting? It's not just that the police make a sweep of hospital parking lots and also check-ins and morgues, which they do, but they actually do a sweep of Don's neighborhood. Now, that tells me something. The police are not ignoring Don. Indeed, they have, I think, been somewhat pointed in his direction by Young Lee, saying, well, this is who my sister is dating right now. This idea, which I'm going to make very clear in this episode, that the Baltimore County Police Department did not do any kind of follow-up or serious questioning on Don is a myth. It doesn't say anything at all about the police doing a sweep of Adnan's neighborhood. No, just Don's. But there is no crime. They've done what they can. And so things rest there. Now, I am going to postulate here, and I'm going to develop these ideas much more fully in a separate episode about Hope Schaub. But I believe that Hope Schaub, who you will remember, was Hayes' French teacher, but she was really much more than that. She was Hayes' mentor. Hay was her student aide. They spent about an hour and a half together every single morning on a regular school day. I think it's fair to say that they were friends. They were only 8 years apart in age. Later on, Hope Schaub is going to say in the HBO documentary that she thought of Hay almost like a daughter. But that is absolutely not how she thought of her at the time. She's looking back over 20 years. At the time, the two young women were basically almost contemporaries. I think if you want to posit any kind of family relationship, it's almost like big sister, little sister. They liked each other. They ate breakfast together. They are friends. And I think when Hope Schaub showed up Tuesday morning, January 19th, remember, there have been 5 days of no school, 2 days because of the ice storm, 2 days because of the weekend, and then Monday was Martin Luther King Jr. Day. When she walks into that classroom and realizes Hay is actually missing, it's not just that she went off to be with Don for a day or two. I believe she called the police. And she identified herself with all the roles that she played in Hay's life. And she asked, have you looked at Don Kleindienst? Because Hay said she wanted to go live with him. I think that's what set in motion this further police interview that takes place on Friday, January 22nd. And at this point, we have the entrance of a new policeman, a new police detective into the mix here. His name is Joseph O'Shea, and I'm going to have to say that my hat is off to Detective O'Shea. He does a lot more work on this case than he actually has to, always keeping in mind that this is not totally just altruism. This is partly, at least, because of the public pressure that is being brought to bear over Hay's disappearance, because it seems to have such a resemblance to the disappearance of Jada Lambert the previous fall. And of course, as we know, she had turned up raped and strangled. Hey guys, you better find this girl before the same thing happens to her. But bearing that in mind, Joseph O'Shea is a very conscientious officer. So what does he say? Well, let's look at this report. This is the first detailed interview that Don Kleindienst is going to give to the police. And O'Shea starts out by saying, the assigned interviewed Don Kleindienst. So he's been put on this case. And he apparently asks Don quite a few very relevant, very pertinent questions. He says, Hay did mention to Donald that she argued with her mother about breaking curfew and phone privileges. And remember, we are talking about a legal adult. Hay had turned 18 the previous October. Now, here's the first important thing that Don says. Hay did not indicate to Donald that she was planning to go anywhere. Now, stop and think about that for a minute. I don't know if this statement from Don was elicited by a direct question or not. Police reports are not recorded the way trial transcripts are. We don't always know what the actual question was. Did Don expect this call? I don't think so. I think after the 14th, especially after the 16th, when Hay's body is safely off their property and in Leakin Park, I think everybody just breathed a sigh of relief. This thing is now over with. But of course, it's not. There are reports on the news. Hay's family is holding vigils. And now, 9 days after the killing, there's this phone call from Officer O'Shea. So I'm kind of picturing Don sweating it out on the other end of this phone line and kind of making things up as he goes along. So first he says, no, I don't think Hay was planning on going anywhere. Then O'Shea elicits from Don the fact that Don and Hay had spent several hours on the phone after Hay had left his house on Tuesday night. So Hay left Don's residence at 22:30 hours, that's 10:30, and paged him when she arrived home at 11:30, and then they stayed on the phone until 3 o'clock the next morning. Don does not have to tell O'Shea this. Maybe he thinks there are phone records. I don't know. Then Don admits, yes, he and Hay were supposed to get together the night of the 13th. That is never followed up on. If there's something you can fault O'Shea with here, it would be something along the lines of asking Don, well, weren't you worried when you didn't hear from her as you expected to? But anyway, this is where Don first says that he was working somewhere else on January 13th and that he therefore has an alibi. Now, I said earlier that when Don got this call from O'Shea on January 22nd, he was not necessarily expecting it at all and was kind of making it up as he went along. However, this idea that he had been working somewhere else must have been an idea that he and his mother and almost certainly Catherine Michelle had kind of workshopped before this. Well, if somebody does check, we can say this. And we do know that Don tells Sarah Koenig when she interviews him on Serial that when he was told that Hay was missing, the first thing he did was try to think about, well, where was I? What was I doing? What can I tell people if they check up? So this is where Don says, I was up at the Hunt Valley store, which is a good 17 miles or so from the Owings Mills Mall. And then he says that he arrived home at 7 p.m. and he was told by his father to call the Owings Mills store. And that was when he was told that Hay was missing. And of course, as I postulate, that has to have come from Catherine Michelle. Although it's not at all clear to me that Don actually got that call at his dad's house. All right, so then I think either on the spur of the moment, or maybe this was another idea that had been thought out beforehand, I just don't know. We have the first mention that maybe Hay has gone off to California. Let me read you the relevant passage. Hay told Donald that she spent the summer of 1997 or 1998 in California with her father. Hay also said she would like to live in California. Now, number one, this idea that Hay had spent a summer in California, I think it was 97, is perfectly true. We know this. Young Lee testified to this at the trial, that he and Hay and his mom had gone to California. They had stayed there for a few months to visit his mother's fiance. This is not Hay's father. Don has the story wrong. I don't think he had ever taken in the complicated dynamics of the Lee family. And so he sort of vaguely thought this was Hay's father, or maybe her stepfather, but it's not. It's at best her mother's boyfriend. And I guess that guy disappeared into the far horizons at some point in this case. But you'll notice something else here. Don had started out this phone call saying, as far as he knew, Hay had no plans to go anywhere, and he ends with saying, Hay also said she would like to live in California. And so, as I say, I think his thoughts are kind of evolving as he's on the phone. Oh, wait a minute. If I say that Hay was thinking of going to California, that's a nice cover story. All right, and then he also has this idea that he has an alibi. He was somewhere else. And this call that he gets from Owings Mills, which I've always maintained is from Catherine Michelle, simply occurs because Catherine Michelle knows what's going on with Don and Hay, and she's concerned. Why hasn't Hay shown up for work? She's never been a no-show, no-call before. So I think this call from Michelle shows very clearly that at this point in the story, she's completely out of the loop. So that January 22nd call seems to be pretty definitive. Don says he has an alibi. Don can account for his time. And again, I know I sound like a broken record here, but as far as the police are concerned, there is no crime. They don't have any excuse, any legal right to go pressing. They have no right to knock on Don's door and say, can we come in and see if that girl is here? Nothing like that is legally permissible. So the matter is allowed to drop for about a week. And sometime, I would say over the weekend, the next weekend, so this would be January 30th and 31st, an organization called Metro Crime Stoppers gets an anonymous tip. And this moves the case forward at least a little bit. So let me stop here for a second and make a couple of points. Number one, let me explain how these tip lines work. They are somewhat problematic because we, as American citizens, do have the right to face our accusers. And yet these tip lines promise anonymity. They also promise, if something is available, a reward if your information that you call in pans out. And yet, again, as a legal defendant in the U.S., you have the right to know if a witness against you was paid for his testimony. Nevertheless, these tip lines continue to exist. Here's how they work. And I want to be very clear here. There is no way that anybody could know who made this call. This is another persistent myth that somewhere buried in the files is the identity of this caller. That is not true. That cannot possibly be true because that is not how these tip lines function. So you call in and you give your information. I think so-and-so did such and such. And specifically, I went on the website of Metro Crime Stoppers as it exists today, and it matches exactly what was said way back at the time of Serial and Undisclosed and Truth and Justice. There is no recording. There is no transcript. The call is not traced, and your information is not taken down. The idea, the tip itself, is written down, and the only means of identifying this caller is an ID number, a four-digit ID number that you are given. And then if you follow the news and you see, oh, so-and-so has been arrested and indicted, those two things must be true, then it is up to you to call back if there is a reward being offered, and say, hey, I'm tipster number so-and-so, and my person whom I gave you the tip about has been arrested and indicted. I should get my reward. And then arrangements are made for you to be met somewhere and be given the reward in cash, in person. Again, no personal information is collected. We know from information that came out much after this case had been tried, that someone at Metro Crime Stoppers passed along the information that yes, indeed, there was a tip called in on February 1st. This tipster, I'm going to call this person the leaker. I don't mean that to be snide or anything, but the person who leaked the idea of this tip does not really spell out exactly what the tip said. But we know from what the police do on February 1st that it must have mentioned Adnan and also, secondarily, Don Kleindienst, because the police go checking up on both of these young men on February 1st. Okay, we'll get to that in just a second here. Let me go on to my idea of who the tipster was, not the leaker, the tipster, the person who actually made the phone call. And again, here's another persistent myth that Jay Wiles made this call. Now, I'm doing a whole episode on Jay Wiles. I find him utterly fascinating. So I'm going to spell out in great, excruciating detail in that episode why Jay Wiles could not possibly have been the anonymous tipster. Here I will just say, he knows nothing. There is no reason for him to make this call, and there is no reward being offered, and there is no suspicion being directed at him. So why on earth would he pull this idea out of thin air? No. The people who originate this call are the people in Hayes' family. They have been sitting there day after day, utterly devastated, grieving, and to their mind, nothing has been done. Now, at some point, and I should have looked up this date and I didn't, so apologies. At some point, the police, this is the Baltimore County Police, have done a search with cadaver dogs in the fields around Woodlawn with a specific interest or focus on areas that are near creeks or streams. This, of course, is obviously because they're thinking in terms of Jada Lambert's murder, that she was found in the woods near a stream. Okay, I'm not sure that the Lees even know this. We do know that the police call the Lees several times to see if they've heard anything. And you can imagine that the Lees have been calling the police, but nobody knows anything. And they're utterly frustrated. What is the one piece of information they have? They have Hayes' diary. And Hayes' diary makes some very scattered references to Adnan's jealousy. Very scattered, very minor, but that's all they have. So my contention is, it's called a February 1st call, but because the police show up at Woodlawn High School so expeditiously on Monday morning, February 1st, I think the call must have come in that weekend. They say you need to look at the boyfriend and the ex-boyfriend. We don't know anything more than that. But the police act on this tip. Now, a lot of people who are pro-Adnan, and believe me, I'm in that camp, see something sinister in the fact that the police show up at Woodlawn right after that tip comes in. Well, what else are they supposed to do? That's exactly the way those tip lines are supposed to work. So they show up at Woodlawn, they would have had to make arrangements, they would have had to call ahead, have a room set aside for interviews, all that kind of thing. And they question Adnan and Hayes and Adnan's friends and apparently a few teachers. And nobody knows anything. And why would that be? Because there is nothing to know. they do a second thing, and that is that they make an attempt to confirm Don's alibi. And they call the Owings Mills Mall. They talk to somebody with the initials of CM, which of course is Catherine Michelle, and they are given some specific times that Don had worked at the Hunt Valley store on January 13th. And why didn't they call the Hunt Valley store? I don't know. Maybe they had the Owings Mills phone number and that was easiest. I have no idea. I'm not sure that they quite realized that they were calling the wrong store. But Catherine Michelle gives them some very specific times. Don reported for work at 9:02. He took a lunch break from 1:10 to 1:42, and then he left work at 6. So either Catherine Michelle is really good at thinking on her feet, and she comes up with these times on the spur of the moment, or they've thought up these times. I do not, however, think that the timesheets have actually been fabricated at this point. That's going to come later, and we'll get to that a little bit farther on in this episode. Now, again, the Baltimore County Police have been somewhat criticized here. Why did they go to Woodlawn and question a bunch of people, but they only make one phone call about Don? Well, because they've already made 3 phone calls about Don, and they've done a sweep of his neighborhood. So at this point, they think, well, we think he's in the clear, but maybe we'd better get the exact times that he worked on the 13th. So they do that. They are given what seems to be pretty specific information. Now we get to February 4th. This is a very important day. This is the last time that the Baltimore County Police are going to contact Don. And 5 days later, on February 9th, Hayes' body is going to be discovered in Leakin Park by our friend Alonzo Sellers, and the case is going to be transferred to Baltimore City. What happens on February 4th? Well, remember I said that Officer O'Shea did more than he had to. He was pretty conscientious. So as of February 1st, I think a fair case could be made for saying that he's done quite a bit of work here, and there's still no crime, there's still no body. And yet he's really trying to be sure that Don actually has an alibi. On February 4th, he decides to go interview Don in person. So remember, up until this point, all of the checking up on Don has been done by phone. 3 calls to Don, and then this one call on February 1st that connects with Catherine Michelle. But for some reason, Officer O'Shea decides, I'd really like to see this guy in person. I'm not satisfied. I don't know. I don't know why. His spidey sense was tingling. Whatever. So on February 4th, he goes to the Owings Mills store and he talks to Don in person. You will remember from the HBO documentary, I'm sure you have it memorized just as I do, that the private investigators who were hired by the documentary tracked down an employee of LensCrafters who said he remembered seeing marks and scratches and cuts on Don's hands right after Hay disappeared, when they were on a smoke break and Don was explaining to everybody that Hay was missing. But February 4th is over 3 weeks later. So any marks on Don's hands have long since healed. What does O'Shea say about this visit? Well, he says, I was told the same thing I had been told before. It just confirmed what we already knew, and that's it. Except that isn't it. So now we're going to get into how the timesheets were faked. Up until the appearance of a never-before-heard-from guest on the relaunch of Undisclosed, a woman named Deborah Renner. We had all kinds of indirect evidence that these timesheets were almost certainly faked, but we did not have any direct witnesses to this. Deborah Renner provides that direct witness. But before we get to her, let me talk about what we already knew before we heard from Ms. Renner, who, by the way, was kept in reserve as a possible witness if Adnan had a second trial, or actually it would be a third trial since we had that first trial that was a mistrial. But since that's never going to happen again, she was brought on to the podcast. And boy, is she a character. I really liked what I heard of her. But let's first of all lay some groundwork here. So here are the things that we have always known about the timesheets that show that Don was working on January 13th all day from 9 till 6, and then that he was also working on Saturday morning. And I explained in the episode, the previous episode, about how Hay's body was put in Leakin Park, almost certainly on Saturday morning, why Anita Baird thought she needed to produce a second timesheet for that morning. That was a big mistake because there's no way that timesheet could be accurate, could be true. But let's look at the two timesheets as a whole. First of all, an issue that has been picked over and argued over countless times, that Don has two different employee ID numbers on these. I don't remember what the exact numbers are. I think the faked ones are 096, and then his actual number is 110, something like that. But that's neither here nor there. The point is that they are different. And so Bob Ruff, who is just an indefatigable investigator, checked up with numerous, I think it was something like 15 former and present LensCrafters employees as of 2015, of course, which is when he was doing his podcast, and asked them about this employee ID issue. He wanted to know, if you're working for a LensCrafters at Mall A, and then you transfer to Mall B, or you're lent out to Mall B for the day, or whatever, would you have a different employee ID number? And everybody said, no, you keep your ID number the same. So because of that discrepancy, he was saying these timesheets must have been fake. However, all props to Bob Ruff, that's not really the case. Don could certainly have had two different ID numbers. Now, I'm going to get a little technical here about computers and networking and all that kind of thing, just to make a point here. So in order for LensCrafters to have that kind of system where you keep the same employee number across the board, all of the stores, all of their timekeeping systems would have to be linked to each other. So for instance, somebody told Bob Ruff, hey, if I'm working in Virginia, say, and I check in and I work in Virginia and then I move to Texas and I get hired at a LensCrafters store there, I will simply walk in and use my same employee ID number to log in. It will not change. But that's only true if they're all on the same system. And what nobody seems to have acknowledged or realized is that, especially back when we're talking the early 2000s, we'll say from 1998, which is when Hay was hired at LensCrafters, and we know Don was already working there, that computer systems, timekeeping systems, computers themselves are in a great state of flux. And of course, that's true even today. Those of us schlubs who own a Windows 10 laptop or desktop that cannot be upgraded to Windows 11 have been told in no uncertain terms that we'll just have to buy a new computer. So this constant change is an ongoing thing. And I really think that the people who talk about the systems that were in place in 2015 at LensCrafters or their parent company, Luxottica, and they assume that the same systems were in place 15 years earlier, have simply never worked in corporate offices. Believe me, I have. I've been through more software and hardware changes than, as my mother used to say, you can shake a stick at. Let me read you, for example, here, what those two private investigators said about the work they did for the documentary. Now, remember, they're even later on in the process. The documentary came out in 2019 as the documentary was being broadcast. They had probably done this work a year or so before. Here's what they had to say. After interviewing more than 15 current and former employees of LensCrafters, employees of Luxottica Group, LensCrafters' parent, and even the developer who built the timekeeping software, we debunked the time card theory. It was, we concluded, impossible to adjust the computerized time card retroactively without leaving a trace. Well, there are two huge problems in that little short paragraph. Number one, they did not ask this developer who built the timekeeping software when they developed it, because what was going on before then is anybody's guess. And then secondly, they say you couldn't do what is supposedly been done, going back and putting in a new time card for two different days. You couldn't do that without leaving a trace. Well, as Colin Miller points out in the relaunch of Undisclosed, there is a trace. Don worked over 5 hours of overtime the week of January 11th through the 16th. And yet he is not shown as getting any overtime pay. If that's not a trace, I don't know what is. I could go on and on about this. I could talk about all of the different iterations that I have been through in my secretarial career, a career which no longer exists, but no matter. All of the changes that have been foisted upon us poor office worker bees by corporate headquarters. So this idea of the software is totally irrelevant. So we have that problem. We also have the problem, and to me this is totally dispositive, that A, there is no reason for Don to have a faked timesheet for Saturday morning if it was just sort of a fail-safe thing. You know, he and his mom were afraid that he might be suspected, so they decided to create a timesheet showing that he was working that day, when maybe, well, we know he wasn't working that day, which we'll get to here, but maybe he couldn't alibi himself. As he said to Sarah Koenig, I immediately started thinking about how I could account for my time. Okay, well, let's make a timesheet for you. But then why would they have made that timesheet for Saturday morning if he really is innocent? That makes no sense. So I went into my theory of that Saturday morning time card, the reason for it, in the last episode. Here, I just want to point out that, again, as I said last time, there is not enough time for Don to have gotten from the fake shift at Hunt Valley to the real shift at Owings Mills on Saturday, January 16th. That proves that one of those timesheets is fake. And it has to be the one that's already been shown to be faked because, well, now we get to it, because of this eyewitness, Deborah Renner. So who is Deborah Renner? She was an employee of LensCrafters from 1995 to 2000. And for a big chunk of that time, she was working at the Hunt Valley store with Anita Baird, and Don Kleindienst. And she says that at some point, and it would be before 1998, Luxottica, the parent company, made this decision that members of the same family could no longer work at the same store. So Don gets transferred to Owings Mills, and Catherine Michelle gets transferred out also. Brenner says she thinks she went and worked at Towson for a while, but of course we know that she ended up at Owings Mills with Don. Now, I could spend a lot of time here trying to untangle this. Let me just say that almost certainly on your employee application, you had to put down whether or not you had any family members who also worked for LensCrafters. So Don would have put down, yes, Anita Baird, my mother. And then I'm not quite sure why Catherine Michelle would have been transferred, because at this point, she and Anita Baird are not married. They are not legally family members. But I think what happened there was that they had the same address. And so they were questioned. And it was determined that, well, we think it would be better if the two of you were not working at the same store. So Catherine Michelle is out. Deborah Renner says that she was very relieved when Don got transferred because she didn't like him. She felt that he was creepy, that he gave her the creeps, that he had this very dark personality. Okay, well, that's just a subjective evaluation here. It's not proof of anything. Then she has a very interesting story to tell about February 4th. So here's what she says happened. She says that Anita Baird and Thomas Kilbean, who has since died, who was a lab manager and who had been Don's lab manager, were trying to put Don back into the system at Hunt Valley. By this point, of course, Don has been transferred to Owings Mills. And the fact that they're talking about putting Don back in the system for this store tells me that at this point, the stores are not linked to each other. So this everybody having the same employee ID number is not valid. They would simply have all sent their timekeeping records directly to the home office, and then paychecks would have been issued from there. But Don has left that store, and he's no longer in their computer, which Deborah Renner says was sitting on the counter in front. So that's where employees would come in, and they would check in, and then they would stay at the counter if they were working retail, or they go back to the lab. So Baird and Kilbean are trying to get Don back in the system. And they're not having any luck for some reason. Maybe they just don't really quite understand what they're doing. It's not clear exactly how the system worked at the time. Deborah Renner is overhearing this. Remember, the computer's right up there on the front desk. And so she says, well, I didn't know much about computers, but I thought I would stick my oar in, as I would put it. She wants to see if she can do something here. And she says, I'm not sure exactly what I did. I think I added his middle initial. And all of a sudden, the record was created. Well, guess what, Deborah Renner? That is exactly what you did. Because the two timesheets that we believe are faked have Don's middle initial, whereas the other ones do not. Okay, so Baird and Kilbean, she says, were quite pleased. And Renner was kind of patting herself on the back. And she may have asked, well, why are you guys trying to do this in the first place? And she was told, oh, well, Don may end up coming back and working at this store, and we want to be sure that he's in the system. Which, of course, is a bunch of nonsense. Don cannot come back and work at that store as long as Anita Baird is working there. And Deborah Renner is not very happy at the idea of Don coming back and working there because she doesn't want to be around him. But that's fine. She's gotten a pat on the back from a manager, actually two managers, so she's quite pleased. She is a manager in training. So far, so good. Then she says, later that afternoon, the police came. I am assuming that this has to be February 4th because this is the only time that we have any record of a policeman going in person to a Lynn's Crafters store. So what I'm thinking must have happened is that O'Shea, after making that call on February 1st and being given those specific times for Don's work on the 13th, is still not satisfied. He decides, I want to talk to this guy in person. So he goes in on February 4th. Again, is this announced ahead of time? No, of course not. He walks in, he asks for Don, he sits down, and he says, tell me again about January 13th. And Don says exactly what he said before. I was working. Maybe he gives O'Shea those exact same times that Catherine Michelle had given O'Shea on the phone on February 1st. That should be it. But again, O'Shea is not happy. He's not satisfied. He wants to see the actual time cards. And he could have said something like, well, you know, just so I have something to round out my report, can you give me copies of your time cards? Oh, Don thinks, no, I can't. So he says, no, those timesheets are at the other store. I can't access them here. Now, of course, O'Shea could have thought, but I called here. And I was given your times by a manager who works here. I didn't call Hunt Valley, but maybe he didn't make the connection. I don't know. So Don says, if you want to see my actual time cards on the computer, you'll have to go to Hunt Valley, thinking, I hope he doesn't do that. And O'Shea may have said, okay, I'll keep that in mind. Or maybe he just walked out. We don't know. If he's smart, he didn't say anything, but you can imagine a panicked phone call from Don to his mother at Hunt Valley saying, the police have been here and they want to see my actual timesheets. And that is when Anita Baird and Thomas Kilbean start trying to get Don into the system and Deborah Renner unwittingly helps them. All right, so the police come. And she says the police, she almost makes it sound as if it's a group of people, but it really can't be. It's just Officer O'Shea. And she, that is Deborah Renner, is perturbed. As she put it, I guess I got my little girl feelings hurt because Anita Baird and Kilbean take the police officer into the manager's office in the back. And when Deborah Renner says, oh, well, I'd like to come along too. What's this about? They say, no, you don't need to be in on this. And they firmly shut the door. Now, of course, they don't want Deborah Renner in that meeting. She will say, wait a minute. This is what I just helped you to do. I just helped you put Don into the system. And if she's really alert, she'll say, wait a minute. You're checking up on whether or not Don worked on January 13th? I was working on January 13th. He's not worked here since he got transferred to Owings Mills. What are you guys talking about? What are you guys trying to pull? So she's kept very firmly out of that meeting. She says that the meeting went on for an hour. Now, I think Deborah Renner is absolutely credible, but I don't think she's right about the amount of time here. Our perception of time is very, very elastic and relative. I think it felt like an hour because she was out there in the front thinking, what are they doing back there? Why didn't they let me be in on the meeting? And of course, Baird must have done a printout to show to O'Shea because they cannot have O'Shea out there looking at the computer in front of Deborah Renner for the reasons I just mentioned. So I would say O'Shea doesn't stay very long. 10 or 15 minutes at the very most, but boy, that seems like an eternity to Deborah Renner. And then O'Shea leaves. And he thinks, well, I don't know. I've done everything I can think of to do to break down this guy's alibi, and every time I check up on it, somebody confirms it. So Don has confirmed it, of course. Catherine Michelle, over the phone at Owings Mills, has confirmed it. Then he's seen Don in person, and then he's actually seen the physical timesheets. Now, folks, I ask you, what is this man supposed to do? And you can say all you want about, well, he should have noticed that the employee ID numbers were different. He should have noticed that the name was slightly different. But not to, you know, be too unkind, that's a bunch of hogwash. He has been presented with what he thinks is cut and dried evidence, and he lets it drop. And when Hay's body is found 5 days later, he will transfer all of this information to Baltimore City, and he will say in those files, we have checked up on this Don Kleindienst guy every way from Sunday, and we cannot find any weakness in it. But we will get to that whole discovery, quote unquote, of Hay's body and the transfer to Baltimore City in a later episode. Here, I want to finish Deborah Renner's story because, boy, does she have more to say. So she says to Rabia and Colin that she didn't really know much of anything about the Hayman Lee case at the time. She didn't watch the news much. And she says that this whole idea of a LensCrafters employee having disappeared and then turned up murdered was kept pretty quiet, at least at her store. Nobody was talking about it. And of course, Hay was not an employee at that store, and neither was Don. There was talk about it at Owings Mills, but not at Hunt Valley. And so she knew nothing about it. It went right over her head. And then in around 2016, she thinks, a member of the investigative team on the HBO documentary gets in touch with her. Now, here's another group that I just give full props to. That HBO team did an enormous amount of work. In the end, the section of material that included Deborah Renner's story didn't even make it into the documentary. Nevertheless, what HBO apparently did under the auspices of Amy Berg, who was the overall producer slash director, who did a fabulous job, I must say. One of the things that the team tried to do was to track down the 13 people who were on the roster as having worked at Hunt Valley on January 13th. And one of them, of course, was Deborah Renner. I don't know how many other people they were able to track down. But Renner says that she very clearly remembers being contacted by a member of the team, and they met for coffee in, I believe she says, Cockeystown, which is where she lived. And she's asked, do you have any memories of this? Do you in particular remember whether or not Don Kleindienst worked on January 13th? Now, of course, we're talking about events that were well over 15 years in the past. But Renner is able to say, no, he would not have worked that day, because he had been transferred by that point. And I was so glad that he was gone, I would remember if he had come back. And then Renner is shown something very interesting. She is shown a summons requiring her to show up at Adnan's trial as a witness. Boy, I would like to know how Christina Gutierrez's law office came up with that idea. Nevertheless, there it is. She was supposed to show up and either confirm or deny Don's alibi, even though, of course, he's not the one on trial. She says, I've never seen that before. And then she says, You know what happened? This must have been sent to the Hunt Valley store. And I was transferred almost immediately after this whole hoo-ha with Don's timesheet. I was given a promotion, and I was transferred all the way up to Annapolis, which made me kind of mad because that was a long ways, as she puts it. That was a hike. But she didn't feel that she had any real options. If she wanted to keep her job and if she wanted to get this promotion, she had to take this transfer. And Rabia Chaudhry says, and who would have had the authority to do this, this promotion and transfer? And Renner says, Anita Baird. So as far as I'm concerned, Renner's testimony pretty well seals the deal. She knows that Don did not work at Hunt Valley on January 13th. And then she knows that she inadvertently helped, as she puts it, Anita Baird to create an alibi. That's how she felt later when she thought about it. And then she knows that she never got that summons. So all of these ideas together, I believe, have to lay to rest, as I said at the beginning of this episode, the question of whether or not there were faked timesheets involved in this case. Yes, there were. Come back next week, and we're going to have an episode about Alonzo Sellers. We're going to fill in some gaps about him, and then we can move forward and talk about him as the so-called discoverer of Hayes' body. See you then. Thanks for listening.